You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this month to talk about limited collector's edition number C44 starring Batman are the two hosts of the newest show here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Batman Family Reunion, Paul Kian and Sean Myers. Hi, guys.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having us.
Howdy, chums.
Thank you both for doing this. I'm very excited to have you on the show. And for anyone who hasn't listened to the show yet, and who hasn't at this point, why don't you guys describe what Batman Family Reunion is?
Well, Rob, it's a read-through show of the Batman Family Reunion, Batman Family comic from 1975 to about 1980. It went for 20 issues and then continued for 15 more issues in Detective Comics in dollar comic size. And we go through each of the stories, have a look at some of the special features like the text pages and the ads and so forth, and have a little fun along the way while eating fried chicken. So we have a good time with it. It's been a lot of fun putting the show together, and couldn't have done it without your support and the rest of the network support. So we really have enjoyed it.
We are very happy to have this show on the network. It is a lot of fun. Now, Sean, I know that the dollar comic is your favorite all-time format is the DC dollar comic. Is that right?
It's a tough toss-up between dollar comics and digest comics for literally the exact same reason. The digest was 95 cents. The dollar comics obviously were a dollar. But for that amount of money, you always got a ton of stories. So dollar comics were almost all new stories. Digest, I got to revisit DC's past. Anything like that, anything like with a group situation, JLA, I love that because I got so many characters. Dollar comics, I got four or five stories in each issue. Digest, the same thing. Like those two formats, I love them.
Now, Paul, do you have a particular favorite comic book format? And just because you're on Treasury Cast, don't feel the need to say Treasury Edition.
Well, you know, the format, I mean, I don't know that I'm as big a Treasury fan as you, Rob, but who is? I have quite a few of them. I don't have all of them. I think Sean may have me beat out on those, but I do like the Treasuries. I am a big fan of anthology books in general, from the old 100-page Super Spectaculars to the dollar comics to even today. You know, DC puts out a quarterly book on different holidays, and you know, you get, you know, every once in a while there's gems in there, you know, and so I just like the anthology format the best. You know, the Treasury is best for the art, obviously, and we'll talk more about that in the show, but and I have to say, Sean, I know you love your digests, and I have a number of them, but I just can't read them anymore. My eyes are too bad.
That is, I unfortunately have suffering from the same affliction. I have all the digests sitting on a shelf. I have the complete collection of DC digests, but yeah, I can't read them anymore. they're just ornaments that sit on a shelf. I'm too old at this point. So
at least I'm nearsighted, so I can bring them close to my face to look at them.
There you go.
I think part of it is the newsprint. Like they're just the pages have gotten so brown that can't read them anymore. But you know, again, they still look pretty. You know, on the shelf, they look really pretty.
As long as there's not a Slurpee cup in front of them.
The Slurpee cups are higher up on the wall. Don't worry. But yeah, I know you were deeply offended that I had my Slurpee cups in front of my digest there briefly. So, well, you've both been on the show before, so we don't have to get into your histories with the format such as it is. We can get right into this book. As I mentioned, it's limited collector's edition number C44. Cover lead is Batman, of course. This was on sale March 4th, 1976. Well, I do want to talk about this cover. Painted by Wally Fax.
Yeah.
And obviously it is his gloss on a drawing by Carmine Infantino. That's a Carmine Infantino original. Now, this cover is of course unique in that it is the only cover, to my knowledge, that appeared on both a Treasury and a Digest.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the cover of Best of DC Digest number 3, an all Batman edition. So it shares that it has that unique distinction of being the only piece of art that ran twice. Now, this Wally Fax guy, I looked him up, and according to Mike's Amazing World, he only has one other credit in all of comic books, and that is the cover to The Secrets of Sinister House number 2. And if you look at that, that's not a painted cover. That's a drawn cover. So I have no idea whether that, I mean, Mike's Amazing World generally is very accurate, so I have no reason to think it's incorrect, but it seems strange to me that Mr. Fax's two credits in all of comic books would be a painted cover and then a drawn cover for a mystery title. That just seems very strange.
So I was curious about this too. As soon as I saw that on Mike's Amazing World, I dug, and I did find one thing on the DC wiki where it talked about a very small amount about Wally Fax. He apparently was friends with Joe Orlando. Mm-hmm. They attended something called the Art Students League together. And it says that Fax created a few covers and an interior story for the mystery horror comics that Orlando edited, but there are no other credits for him that I could find anywhere in Grand Comics Database or Mike's Amazing World or anywhere. So apparently he was friendly enough with Joe Orlando. He said, hey, you want to take a stab at this? And then somehow got connected to paint this cover. So I was mystified.
Yeah, it's a little strange. Now, what do you guys think of this as an image? Again, it's a Carmine Infantino drawing, but he's doing this sort of photorealistic painting of it. What do you guys think of it as a cover and as an image of Batman?
I love it. Especially back in that time, used to seeing painted of superheroes. So like it was like to me, because like, oh my gosh, this looks real. Like the Marvel paperbacks that had the painted covers, this cover.
Well, I really like it. I like Sean. I think it gives a flavor of a little more impressionistic, right? Look at the city behind it, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The bat signal. Not quite sure I understand the source of the bat signal. It looks like it's just coming out of a window. But other than that, it's like somebody turned on the light in their bathroom and this comes out. But no, it's a cool cover. It's definitely striking. It pops off this white, background. I know, Sean, you would prefer to see it cover the whole cover as opposed to the box that it's in, but it is a striking cover. No question about it.
But if you're going to do a boxed cover, this is the way to do it. Like I know I have a problem with boxed covers, but this, I just think it looks so sharp.
It is relatively unmysterious. Batman is not skulking. He's not doing, he's just standing there. He's doing kind of like a Superman pose, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, the city is very, it's got those red skies, like the crisis is happening or something. And
yeah,
Gotham certainly looks pretty dismal, which is kind of more of like a later thing. It would have been interesting to see this as a full frame cover as opposed to the giant white order that they place around it. Now, maybe Mr. Fax, when he painted, obviously, maybe that's the full length of the painting. Like, it didn't go any further. So if they blew it up, then the logo would be covering Batman's head and the bat signal, and you can't have that. So, for whatever reason, this does feel like something that would have appeared on like a Batman paperback. Like you just mentioned the Marvel ones. Those don't exist, but it feels like it's something you would have seen on that. That would have been that kind of like a Batman pulp adventure, this kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting. And then, of course, we see that same exact drawing on the inside cover, on the table of contents, except it's by Carmine Infantino directly. Yeah. So it's the same exact drawing right there on the inside cover.
Yeah, no, I thought that was neat. And you could see, some of the differences in style, but he clearly was painted over the drawing, which I thought was a very interesting way to do it.
Yep. So the first story is Castle with Wall-to-Wall Danger, from Detective Comics number 329. It is by John Broome, Carmine Infantino, and Joe Gella. So the plot of it is Batman and Robin receive a tip that Pragnell, a wanted criminal, is in England. They fly to England to find Pragnell and extradite him. When they arrive at the castle at which Pragnell was seen, they realize that the castle owner, Albert Munch, merely looks similar to the crook. Though their mission seems to have failed, the dynamic duo accepts Munch's invitation to dinner. While in the castle, several attempts are made to kill Batman and Robin. Soon, they are attacked outright by two thugs and a man in a trench coat. When they capture him, the man turns out to be Pragnell, alias Vincent Munch, Albert's cousin. Pragnell was searching for his cousin's castle and for hidden Nazi gold and threatened Albert's family to keep him in line. Batman returns to America with Pragnell, and Albert eventually finds the gold. So, Sean, let me start with you. What did you think of this story?
I think this is so much fun. It's like a Saturday morning serial where there's danger after danger after danger. Danger on every page. I think it's fun. I love it. He actually talks about it not being so – Batman talks about it not being so much of a mystery. And I do love Batman the detective. But I just think it's so neat. I really enjoyed this story.
Paul?
Yeah, I agree. What's funny is I was going to make that same point, Sean, that there's – you know, this is supposed to be – if there's any theme bringing these stories together, it's sort of a mystery type, you know, puzzle twist kind of theme. But this one, you know, you're presented like it's a mystery, but it's really not much of a mystery. They didn't have to do any detective work like they will in the next couple stories. So, but it's, you know, it's fun. The couple funny parts now, it's interesting to read these ones from before the Batman 66 TV show, because, you know, this is originally published in 1964. And so you can see the elements of where some of them come out. You know, where some of that comes out with the death traps and, you know, Batman and Robin having to escape it. I always like that kind of thing. It's kind of neat. You know, it's overall, it's fun. You know, not a lot of adventure, not a high level of danger, I didn't feel, but it was fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much myself. And like you were talking about, Sean, it does feel very movie serially. He's very like Perils of Pauline kind of thing, or Batman's constantly falling into trap doors and, you know, he's going to drown. And it has that kind of, and, you know, we're also used to all these Batman stories where he's always taking on his rogues gallery. So it's nice to have a change of pace where it's like he just goes on an adventure, basically. It is kind of funny that they travel all the way to England. Like, really? You couldn't send the Scotland Yard after this guy? Was he really that level of a criminal, this Pragnell guy? I love the way Carmen Infantino tells the story. I love that he changes up the panel widths and, mm-hmm. and heights to, you know, reflect the kind of the angles that we're going when Batman is diving, falling through the down to the into the well. The panels are tall and narrow, and then they get very horizontal. It moves along at a really brisk pace, and it just has a real kind of light, fun touch to it. I also did enjoy the little bonus features, of course, because this was reprinted from a 60s story, as Paul just mentioned. So they had a half page to fill. And on the page where Batman is in the water, you've got this little game, and it's like find birds in this thing. And I love that, you know, DC was so old school. They obviously found, you know, probably for a song, all these cheap puzzles that they could just reprint. Mm-hmm. And they had to find a way to kind of tie it into something. So they're like, oh, birds. Okay, let's just slap the penguin on it. And therefore, it's Batman related. Because you know that this thing did not have the penguin on it initially. It probably had a drawing of a bird. And they were like, well, if we put penguin, then it's Batman-y, right? Yeah, that'll fit. Sure.
Yeah, I actually went and tried to do the puzzles. And then I read the instructions again. I'm like, wait a minute. They say it starts with all the white letters. But I don't know about your copy. My copy, the letters are red. And so it's like the P that penguin starts with. At the top left, it's filled in red. So they, you know, so I was like, the instructions aren't quite right here, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's another one at the end of the story, the picture math. And again, there's no connection to Batman other than they just took a piece of stock art, which looks like an Irv Novik Batman. And yeah. He's instructing kids how to do it. And I love that DC's kind of trying to pull one over on you a little bit. Like when Marvel did this stuff, they would hire like Marie Severin to do something original. And instead, DC was just like, let's just stat in some old puzzles we have. And do we have a headshot of Batman we can stick in there? Yeah, that's fine. So.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, this one I was scratching my head. I couldn't figure it out. And then I realized the thing was a dagger and not a knife. So I kept trying to do it with knife and I couldn't figure out the puzzle. I had to turn it upside down and figure it out.
I got so frustrated. Damn it. All right.
I was thinking, why did they draw an extra white block to put a letter when they didn't need it?
Yeah, DC's just so old-fashioned in some ways. It's so so wonderfully charming. But yeah, it's a fun adventure.
One thing I loved about the story, there's a lot of things I loved about the story, two of them. So on story page 4, when they get to the castle, and the man says, like, since you're here, you know, the countryside will buzz with news. Batman says, we really have to get back. And then Robin says, gosh, Batman, couldn't we stay just a few hours? We left America so fast, we didn't finish our breakfast, and I'm hungry. I literally can hear Burt Ward saying that. Like, that exactly is something from the TV show, even though it predates the TV show. The other thing which I treasure is
nicely done.
Story page 6, when the trap door opens underneath Batman, how elegant Carmine Infantino drew Batman. He looks horrible in the panel, and I absolutely love it.
That awkward leg pose that he's got, like, going there.
His arm is up and his wrist is tilted. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's cape is flowing back.
Yeah.
No, we had one of these stories in Batman Family Reunion 2, Rob, where we talked about, you know, Carmine Infantino. This is the real, you know, at his peak, right? In the late 50s and through the 60s, he really was a great storyteller. I probably first really knew him when he came back to The Flash in the late 70s, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't care for it. But when I read these stories, I really appreciate his storytelling technique a lot better.
Yeah, it's very clean. It's very, again, it is very elegant. It doesn't have quite the smoothness of the Flash stuff he did, but it is really pretty. And it benefits from the treasury size, as we've talked about across episodes. Some artists do not benefit from their stuff being blown up, or at the very least printed at the size they originally did it. But Infantino, its stuff holds up really well. And Joe Giello was a good anchor for him. He had a nice smooth line. So yeah, it's a really smooth running story, and it's a lot of fun. So the next story is Trademarks of Crime, and Paul, why don't you take it away?
Okay, so Trademarks of Crime was originally published in Batman number 31 from 1945. The writer was Joseph Green, pencils by Jerry Robinson, and inks by George Rosas. Batman and Robin are on patrol, and they happen upon a thief robbing an apartment while blaring his radio during the heist. The robber gets away when Batman trips over a drugged dog. back in the Batcave, the dynamic duo used their detective skills and checked their high-tech microfiche database, looking for a crook who uses drugged dogs and distracting music. Amazingly, they find him. Over the next few days, they nab a few more criminals for crimes committed with strange trademarks until one of them has a pretty good alibi. He was actually in jail at the time of the crime. Batman deduces that someone is framing them all using their own trademark criminals' methods against them. He suspects the sweet old cleaning woman, Mrs. Darling, who cleans the police records room where their files are kept. So Batman and Robin and Commissioner Gordon go to her apartment and question her, but she denies the charges, saying she hasn't been to GCPD all week. But Batman isn't convinced, and he later matches fibers from her apartment to one of the crime scenes. Batman and Robin return, but are ambushed by the cleaning woman and her men. During the melee, Batman snags a darning needle from the old woman's table and stuffs it down his shirt before being tied up in the basement. Robin is then able to get at it using his teeth, so we better not let Dr. Wortham read this story. Anyway, the dynamic duo escape. They track down the woman's mob on their next robbery, capturing all of them, including all the crooks from the previous robberies, who they thought were framed, but were actually involved the whole time. So they go back and arrest Mrs. Darling, who turns out not to be such a nice old lady after all. So what'd you guys think? Sean, you want to go first?
I will. It's funny. Normally, the art style I love the most is very clean. So like if you're like George Perez or Phil Jimenez or Parabek, like that, you know, very, very animated style. But for whatever reason, this almost scratchy Jerry Robinson, I love. And maybe it's just the story, maybe it's just the size, but I just think this artwork is so neat. I really, and especially like, it feels like crime. Like his style feels like crime.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, how about you, Rob, on the overall, before we go to the story beats?
First of all, I love that pull quote. His art looks like crime. That's just a great pull quote. I have to say I was distracted. Does Commissioner Gordon not have a second suit? Because he's in that same damn purple suit in the first story. He's in the second story. And these comics take place 20 years apart. Come on, Commissioner Gordon, get a second suit. It's kind of funny. I like Jerry Robinson quite a bit. His Batman is a little kind of doughier than... we're sort of used to it, Batman. There's one panel a couple of, like, around the middle of the story where we see Batman and kind of, like, just, like, is in his waist. What page is it? It's like, oh, God. It's the one where he goes, and then the next panel. And
yeah, he just, oh, yeah.
Yeah, he kind of looks like Adam West Batman. Like, he's kinda, okay. I like it, but this is one of the cases where I don't think being blown up does it a whole lot of favors. Yeah. Because I think it was kind of minimalist in some ways. Some of the panels have like purposely no backgrounds. So I think they might have looked better a little, you know, squeezed down a little. But overall, yeah, I think it's an attractive looking book. I like how many panels are draped in darkness. Yeah. Like, this is a dark night story, which yeah. I like quite a bit. So that part of it was cool. And of course, as we're kind of going through, you realize, yes, the theme of this, without it being put on the cover, is Batman as a detective, because he's not really taking on any of his foes here. This is Batman being the you know, the world's greatest detective, so it fits that theme. I can see how that's why they maybe pulled it out. Speaking related to the story, who the hell is Joseph Green?
Okay, well, Joseph Green, we actually I was going to wait till the end. I'm going to tell you this. We actually have a story by him. Yeah, that's reprinted in Batman Family number 3. So oh, when wow. episode 3 comes out in March. And we wax his car quite a bit about that story. This story was pretty good, but that story is called Batman of the Year 3000, and that's a fantastic story. And so everybody, if you want to hear more about Joseph Green, he basically he was a pretty prolific guy in some other areas, and he wrote like 50 or 60 stories for DC in the early 40s. So, including a number of Batman ones, but you know, this was pretty good. Like I really like it. I like, you know, it's some of it's silly. Like, you know, they have these big advancements and it's microfiche. You know, they got one up on the GCPD and Batman, you know, takes the fibers and is looking through a microscope at the fiber and matching it to the scene of the crime. Right. And, so that kind of stuff, I really dig. And you know, the story holds together, and it's kind of like a double twist. First, you think it's these weird trademarks, then you think they're all innocent and somebody else. Turns out they're all in it together, led by this old lady. So, you know, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty well done for only, you know, 8 or 10 pages of story, in my opinion. You know,
as a library professional, I'm thinking the microfiche, that must have been Sean, like your favorite part.
What? First, yes, absolutely. I love microfiche. I don't get to use it enough. But speaking of the microfiche, I absolutely love that they're looking at the criminal profile of Nipper Suavo, who is a master of disguise. Gentleman is 5'3". So it does amaze me that you would have a man come in who's dressed as a zookeeper who is 5'3". And then later you have a man who comes in as a milkman who is 5'3". And then you have a man who comes in as a dog catcher who is 5'3". And you never realize it's the same man. He is a master of disguise.
He should have dressed up as Al Pratt the Atom. He would have thrown Batman off at that point. That would have been great. No, we wouldn't know that.
Would have, yeah.
Yeah.
I have to tell you guys that on the page 7 of the story, I think my favorite panel, though, is the one where the old lady tells Batman to sit down and she puts her knitting yarn in Batman's hand. So he's holding the yarn for her. You can imagine Christian Bale or Ben Affleck. I will hold your yarn to embrace vengeance.
Knit one, pearl two. Yeah,
knit okay. One, pearl two. Yeah. You know, so that's my favorite part right there in that story. But overall, you know, it's a fun story. It's got pretty good. I mean, it's not Jim Aparo or Neil Adams action like the fight scene on the 1, 2, 3, 5th story page. You know, at the top of the page. You know, but you know, Jerry Robinson's doing his best. You know, comic books were still new back then.
Yeah,
I think the jujitsu move looks like it should be a flip book.
Yes. pages. Yeah. My favorite part actually is when the old lady gets arrested and she starts cursing. I love that. And she's trying to knee the cop in the groin. She's got her leg up. And, you know, it's like, I mean, it's all done in like the little curse, you know, the curly cues and the stars to represent cursing. But, you know, she's like, F you, gumshoe, you know, or something like that. And I love Batman, sweet old lady. Like, that's great. So funny. So, yeah, I'm Jerry. Yeah, I mean, Jerry Robinson, there's a lot of panels with no dialogue at all.
Yeah.
I think is kind of like an interesting way to pace it out. Like, there's this moment, okay, we'll just sort of pause. And, like, kind of what you were talking about, Paul, I mean, this is still kind of early on. They're kind of figuring out how you do this.
Yep.
You know? So I think it was kind of, that was kind of a style that went by the wayside. But in the early days of comics, I was like, well, why not just have a couple of panels of just action? You know? Why not have that work? So.
Well, you know what? The one other last point, I know we're jumping around in this story quite a bit, but the last point I want to make before you move on, Rob, is the only place I was going to disagree with you on the not doing it a favor by being in Treasury size, the first page, the splash page, I don't know. I really love the splash page with the safe. Batman's going, Robin's kneeling down looking at safe cracking Sammy with the two guns. I don't know. I really think that's a cool page, and you get at, you know, them investigating the crime, and it's pretty striking, I think. But I agree with you for the rest of the story.
Yeah, that's a nice splash page. I like Batman thinking. You know, we don't get as much of that anymore. Batman just thinking about stuff. So I doubt there's going to be any scene like that in The Batman coming out in March. There isn't going to be any of that. And after that is our first bonus feature. And boy, howdy, is it a fun feature. Mm-hmm. It is Batman's new home, the Wayne Foundation building. And it is drawn by Terry Austin, the great Terry Austin. And we've got this schematic of Bruce Wayne's overhead penthouse, and we see even the floor plans. Now, this was brought into the comics in the mid-70s after Batman had retired the Batcave. Robin had gone off to college, so Batman was like, well, you know, I don't need the Batcave anymore. There's even like a famous issue of Batman on the cover where Batman is like, you know, shut the Batcave down, Alfred, we don't need it anymore, and Alfred's crying or whatever, he's got his bowler hat. So I remember all this where Batman essentially moved into the Wayne Foundation. That said, this is the most insane headquarters for any superhero to ever commission. I mean, this is nuts. I mean, first of all, we see that underneath Wayne Foundation, there is a ramp that goes underneath the city to a warehouse, which is how Batman's Batmobile can emerge, you know, miles away, or not miles away, but blocks away from Wayne Foundation, so no one's the wiser. I mean, how the hell did Batman get that put in?
I was thinking the same thing. I love that the schematic of the little underground path and leading to the second level of the garage where the Batcave is. I think that's just fantastic. But, you know, I think about, you know, at one point there was a story of how Batman got a bunch of people to do, you know, sort of compartmentalize how he built the Batcave under Wayne Manor. But then I'm thinking, how the heck do you get guys to do this under this skyscraper in the middle of the city? Not to mention, it's not the most practical skyscraper in the world with the giant tree in the middle, which, I always love the visual of it. But if you start thinking about it, like many of these stories, it's just, it's just too much, but it is a groovy pad.
I was thinking, imagine your office on left-hand uppermost side of the Wayne Foundation building, and you need to go down to the other side diagonally to have a meeting or to go somewhere.
Well, you have those nice glass elevators in the middle. I guess you go down the ones, not the other. Oh my God.
So many people at Wayne Foundation have tried to just climb that tree down just to save time. it doesn't work. Yeah. It is a poor use of space. And then related to that, we see the penthouse that Bruce Wayne lives on. That is the most terrifying piece of property anybody could ever own, because, I mean, you are right on the ledge. There are trees right on the edge of this thing. You try and trim those. I mean, what the hell are you talking about? Like, what insane person built this? This is Bruce Wayne just throwing money away. It really is.
I think it makes perfect sense. Your house is literally on top of a revolving restaurant.
It's just like, okay. It's, again, beautiful to look at and a great drawing by Terry Austin, but man, it is impractical. Like, you would not believe. But, you know, hey, there.
Hey, but when I was a kid, Rob, I dug this stuff. I would look around, you know, the key. Somebody took the time, whether it was Terry Austin or somebody else, took the time to like locate where all these various things were, where his living room was and bathroom, and Alfred's room and closets and stuff. And I would be flipping back and forth to the back inside cover where it had the key to this and checking out where all that stuff was. So, and we see the inside of it in the later story, right, with all his mid-century modern furniture in there. But yeah, it's a cool pad, and it's got I like the moat. I don't know if you noticed the moat. I don't remember that ever being in a story, but you know, if you look at the top of the right hand side, it looks like there's water around.
Yeah. It goes all the way around. Yeah.
He must have, I mean, think about how much time Batman must have had to waste climbing down this building. And then he would just probably grab a bat rope and jump off. And everybody's like, God, Batman's always constantly jumping off the Wayne Foundation building. What's that about? All right. Well, none of my business. So they're busy throwing pennies into the Thomas Wayne Memorial Fountain there in the front. So, but I mean, that said, I'm making fun of this, but this is exactly the kind of stuff I bought the treasuries for, was this bonus material. Where else are they going to put this? You know? So I absolutely love it. And of course, there was a Mego playset, which was the Wayne Foundation building. Essentially, I don't think they called it that. I think they called it like the Batcave, but it was like basically Barbie's dream house converted into a Batcave. So it looked like the Wayne Foundation building. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm guessing, you know, Terry Austin was the beginning of his career. So I mean, they kind of handed him probably like the scut work of like drawing a building. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to draw a building, but he's like, okay, but it's really a fun piece. So the next story is the Deep Sea Diver Mystery. Sean, your turn.
Our story starts off with Batman and Robin trapped beneath a glass-bottomed boat as the Aquaman villain, the Fisherman, looms above. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Just two mobsters who are calling themselves fishermen. And it's just as well, because the splash page scene doesn't even appear in the story at all. And neither does Aquaman. Sorry, Rob. Our story really starts off outside of Commissioner Gordon's house. By the way, the outside of Jimbo's house is also featured in the Batman Family Reunion podcast episode number 2, available in February, as a deep sea diver in full 20,000 leagues drag is gunned down by a passing car. As Jimmy cradles the dying man, he utters his words, Rosebud, Rutland 5, which later on, the commish tells Batman and Robin, is one of those old-timey telephone exchanges that you'd hear in shows like I Love Lucy and The Dick Van Dyke Show, and wondered how that worked. I'm going to skip over the red herring search, but stop long enough to gaze at the picture of Batman and Robin looming over a miniature scale model of Gotham City, because that is perfection. At this point, Robin says that combing the sewer system would be a workout, which Batman says means a gym, which means a pool, which means trouble, right here in Gotham City. Now, you might think I'm making that part up to shoehorn in any kind of musical reference. You're really not wrong. But it does mean trouble, because Rutland 5 means the Rutland 5-star gym, which is home to the Rutland Ruffians, the gang name I just made up. The Rutland Ruffians trap Batman and Robin in an empty swimming pool, and even though Batman bolos his way out of the trap, one of the Rutland Ruffians severs Robin's rope, fast, and calls a truly painful-looking panel of Robin landing on his face and snapping his neck. Luckily, it's just drawn that way. Then, the back of Batman's head meets the side of a gangster's gun, which sends him to Dreamland. The dynamic duo wake up and find themselves locked in one of those sweat boxes that you see in black and white movies. Batman talks about loosening some thongs, and obviously this is where I'd make a cheap joke, but experience making men's thongs feel tighter, consensually. After escaping, BNR run to the roof where they find a water tower. By the way, a water tower is also featured in the Batman Family Reunion podcast episode number 3, available in March. They decide to Petticoat Junction this mystery and jump right on in. Meanwhile, we find out that Ringo Rutland, really his name, but I'm going to Roy Thomas him so that it is, was the double crosser who shot the scuba man so that he could get the cargo from the water tower. The gang starts draining the water tower H2O long enough so that B&R can't climb out, but not so much that they have to stop sculling. Robin throws a bat line and starts to climb out, but gets smacked in the face for the second time this story, four pages after the first. This time by a blackjack. Batman overhears the plan's thugs, after telling Robin to zip his lip, and meets them at the train yard. By meeting them at the train yard, I mean smashing a train car into the Rutland Ruffians' ride. Say that three times fast. It turns out the big treasure they were after was the paper used to print dollars, which would have made it easy to produce counterfeit money. I'm not going to get into the part with the goldfish, because, whoo boy, that's a stretch worthy of Ralph Dibny and Eel O'Brien. Cousin Paul, what did you think of the story?
Well, once again, your synopsis are very interesting, Sean. As
the, very 100% accurate. Yes, you're right.
but this is a fun story. I think it's got a lot of that adventure you were talking about in the other one. There's the mystery is kind of, you know, the part where the diver, you know, dies right in front of Jim Gordon's house, which is kind of neat. I think my favorite part. It's on the third story page where Batman and Robin are looking at the miniature scale model of Gotham City. Mm-hmm. I love that with the giant faces over the city. Either that or the sweat boxes where the sweat is pouring off of their faces, both of them. But overall, you know, it's a fun story. A lot of these stories that are from the 50s and 60s, you know, it's always Batman gets tricked, Batman gets trapped, and they have to get out of the death trap and all this kind of stuff. And that's something, you know, while if you read a lot of them in a row, it can get overused. It, you know, we don't really see that so much because Batman's perfect nowadays, right? So I always do like the ones where they have to overcome, you know, mm-hmm. some adversity. So those are my initial thoughts. What about you, Rob?
Well, this is from Batman number 83 mm-hmm. by Alvin Schwartz, and it's drawn by Dick Sprang and Charles Paris. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, everyone knows I love Jim Aparo. He's my favorite comic book artist of all time. But man, I could look at Batman drawn by Dick Sprang and Charles Paris all damn day. And I got to tell you, I think if someone said you could either have more live action Batman movies or an animated Batman movie that looked like Dick Sprang, I'd pick Dick Sprang.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, this is thoroughly, as I mentioned about the cover, this is thoroughly unmysterious. You know, Batman is not remotely a creature of the night. This thing looks, Dick Sprang's work is just like a coiled spring. It's kind of amazing he never did Plastic Man because it seems like it would have been fitting. But man, I just drink in his artwork, and getting to see it at a slightly larger size is just a bonus. I love Batman and Robin looming over the mini city. That just looks like the Bottle City of Candor. They're doing that. Jim Gordon, same damn purple suit once again. I love the old timey.
We may start a new segment on Batman Family Reunion, the Rob Kelly Memorial Jim Gordon Purple Suit Award.
I don't know if I want Memorial in there, but other than that, yeah, I would be perfectly fine with that. By the way, nice plugging of your show, Sean. I think that's you really are a true podcaster.
Did I?
I mean, this is just so fun. It's so bloody fun. I love the close-ups of Batman. The death traps are fantastic. I mean, it's the criminals look like Dick Tracy villains. Yeah. Which is great. The splash page, even though, yeah, as you said, it doesn't actually happen in the story. I love the guy in the deep sea diver helmet, just with a handful of money under the water, which is great. I love that when Batman and Robin see the bat signal, like their building looks like it's the Leaning Tower of Pisa, like it's off to this crooked, you know, kind of crooked side. It's so much fun. I just loved it. I just loved everything about it. It's just delightful and goofy and silly. And I even kind of love Batman and Robin kind of doing almost a little kind of blackout ending at the end where they got their hands up like, whoa, like that kind of thing.
That was my. I was going to mention that too. He's like, "Whoa, there, Commissioner Gordon. We're not going. We're not going back on the water."
It's just like, I just love it. It's just a complete blast. And I know that they didn't do this. They wanted to have some variety, but man, I really would have loved like a whole Dick Sprang Treasury, Batman Treasury edition. This is just, it is just utterly charming. And I have to say, I really think I learned about Dick Sprang from the Treasuries, because I don't think I'd ever had seen his work until this point. But I remember him going, man, this is really smooth and slick. And it just, I don't know. I just can't say enough about it. It's a total win.
Well, and I'm really glad, because like at the time this came out, definitely when there were reprints, I liked that they had reprints from the 70s, because that was the Batman I was more interested in. You know, when I started reading Batman, it's kind of like right at the end of Neil Adams. So anytime they reprinted Neil Adams, that was my automatic favorite. And it probably still is. But now I'm glad I can appreciate and Jerry Robinson and just that different kind of storytelling, that different art style. Like, I don't think there's a dud story in this Treasury at all.
Oh, no.
No, yeah, they're all really fun. They're really, really fun. And so, it's a Dick Sprang stuff's just so gorgeous. I just absolutely just love it.
You know, I do want to mention, you know, Alvin Schwartz, you know, let's not forget about him. He wrote a lot of Batman, but I didn't know this till I looked it up in preparation for this. He apparently did both the Batman and the Superman newspaper strips. That's a different skill set, right? To do an ongoing newspaper strip for sure. But I have those IDW reprints, and man, they're super fun.
Yeah, beautiful. They do a great job with those newspaper reprints. So, total winner. Absolute total winner. And by the way, Sean, thank you for bringing in James Michener to do the story synopsis. We really appreciate it. Great. We'll have to send him a check. So after the story, there is another bonus feature, which is a Batman pinup. And it's a drawing by, I believe, Carmen Infantino and Murphy Anderson. And it's Batman and Robin in the Batmobile. And I don't know where this is from. I don't know if this is – I'm highly doubting this is original to the Treasury. It's probably something that appeared in a Batman comic of the 60s at some point, because at this point in the 70s, I don't think Infantino and Murphy Anderson were doing Batman in any respect anymore. The one thing I find mind-boggling is this very bizarre frame they've put around it. which this makes me feel like this is a Batman pinup that you gave your grandmother, and then she decided to put it on a nice doily and put it up against the wall. It's just, it really, I don't know why they felt the need to put that border there. Just blow the picture up a little bit bigger. I don't know what that's about.
For me, I think it makes it look like it's a placemat.
Yeah, there you go. It's even better. Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and I was kind of scratching my head on it. But, you know, I had the same thought, Rob, and I looked at this. I thought it was Infantino, Murphy Anderson, but Grand Comic Database says just Murphy Anderson, so I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know where it came from either, whether it was new or whatever, but this one I really like, definitely worth the limited collector's edition format for sure.
Yeah, it's got the cool, the Batmobile is cool, you know, it looks great. Like I said, I can't imagine where this would have run in a regular comic, because it would have had to cross two pages, and they wouldn't have done that back then. So yeah, I don't, maybe this was original. Murphy Anderson was still working at DC, so maybe they asked him to, you know, bang this out or something. But yeah, the it does look like a placemat now that you're saying. This is, feels like it's, I believe you see that pattern on the credits to Mama's Family. I think it's that same pattern you see there. So, anyway, the final story is Paint a Picture of Peril from Detective Comics number 397. It is by Denny O'Neil, the aforementioned Neil Adams, and Dick Giordano. Batman attempts to stop four thieves from robbing an art exhibit on the waterfront. He is wounded during the fight and must abandon his pursuit of the crooks. He discovers that they took only one painting that was not even significantly valuable. When Batman returns to his penthouse as Bruce Wayne, he hears a news report concerning Orson Payne, a wealthy recluse. Once he is recovered from his injury, he sets out after the crooks whose trail leads to Payne's mansion. The man has been driven mad by the loss of his fiancée years earlier. Payne is now hiring men to steal artwork which contains images resembling his former love. After narrowly avoiding a death trap, Batman captures Payne. Later at his penthouse, Bruce Wayne makes the connection that his cleaning woman, Kathy, is really Payne's former fiance. Wow. Paul, what did you think of this?
Okay. Well, you know, first of all, it goes without saying, I mean, it's beautiful art, right? I mean, it's Neil Adams at the peak, with one exception that I don't think is Adams' fault that I'll get to, when we get there. But, you know, the plot, you know, Denny O'Neill wrote a lot of fantastic Batman stories. This one is kind of okay. But it's very suspenseful in terms of, like, you know, why is this guy doing this? And I guess that's the mystery. But it was just a little weird with the nuclear submarines and the cleaning lady who's clearly like a Chekhov's gun. You've never seen her before or after.
Right.
Right. So, you know, she's going to factor in, you know, you got Batman using a payphone. You know, you've got all kinds of, you got the guy with a death trap in his art room. So it's a little difficult to hold together for a 1970s type story, but man, it sure is pretty to look at. That's my overall. How about you, Sean?
It's funny. Maybe just like 4 minutes ago, I said there's not a dud in the bunch. I may have been on my Adams high because the artwork is fantastic. We can cut and paste that 300 times and it would be true. But yeah, the story, like, I really hate that she gave up her opera career to be a charwoman and happy because she was away from this man. And maybe I'm wrong. I think Orson Payne is probably based on the director Alfred Hitchcock. Am I right in thinking that?
I figured there's a little bit of, you know, a little Orson Welles, a little...
Oh, I didn't get that. That was really subtle.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Paul, but it is kind of the Chekhov's cleaning lady, because you're like, yeah, since when does Batman need a cleaning lady for any reason? Can Alfred do that? I mean, I know he's busy, but I mean, would you really want a paid... woman wandering around Batman's penthouse? That doesn't seem like
with it. keys, who came back in because she forgot her purse.
Yeah, right. In the middle, yeah. She comes in, oh, hey, I forgot my mop.
Yeah, and then why are you wearing that Batman suit, Bruce?
Yeah. What's all the scar tissue on your back? What is that about? Yeah. Yeah, it feels very much like a Perry Mason episode with some Batman action thrown in, basically. Yeah. But as you were saying, Sean, about the Neil Adams high, it's put across so beautifully.
Yeah,
by Adams and Giordano, that you kind of don't mind. And in fact,
you forget it. You just go with it. Yeah.
Neil Adams even brings almost a little too much Neil Adams-y intensity to it, because that panel with the giant close up of Orson's face, you think me insane? Oh. It's almost like, whoa, this guy, wow.
Crazy eyes. Yeah, I had a note for that, those crazy eyes. You know, a couple of the one part that, you know, the only place that I wanted to get your guys' take was, you know, if you look at the fight that Batman has with the scuba guys at the beginning, right? So on the second story page, you see Batman kick the guy and he kicks him so hard that his mask comes zooming out with attached to the rubber on the side of his head. And you can imagine it snaps back and conks him in the nose and hurts again. I love that. But if you turn the page and Batman is swimming away, right, after he hurts his arm, he later on figures, oh, I saw the glowing seaweed. Well, first of all, I don't see any seaweed anywhere.
Yeah.
And second of all, that glow, it's not something that you notice the first time reading. Because I went back and it took me a couple of times to just find that glowing part. And then I'm like, well, maybe it's the printing of the Treasury. So I actually have Detective 397. And I went and looked at that. And the colors are even more muddled in that, in the original. You know, and so I don't know. I didn't follow how Batman knew that the glowing, the leap of the glowing seaweed, which we as readers couldn't see, to, they must have a radioactive sub, so I'm going to get in my little bat sub and follow them, was had me scratching my head, that's all.
Yeah.
But man, the facial expressions, the action, the punch, like he jumps into Payne's house and he punches one of his guards right in the face, and you see his nose like getting all smushed on the side of his face.
Yeah,
that's a great panel.
Yeah, right. Story wise, it probably is the dodgiest of the four. But it just had they knew what they had with the Neil Adams. I feel like every Batman Treasury had at least one Neil Adams reprint in it.
Yeah.
One good thing I think about this story that I do really like is when he comes back to his penthouse, we kind of see him go through, you know, like a routine of, a dab of salve to close the cut, next I'll massage the nerve, and then yoga, deep breathing. I actually did like that. Because it does show, he is still human at this point. He's not invincible. He can be injured. So it is neat to see, the self-care that he has to put himself through.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Sean. Yep. I thought of you, Sean, when I was reading the caption. I mean, there's some great caption on page, it's the one right after the fun shop where Batman's crouching in the tree and he's looking in before he jumps into the art room. And he goes, with a tremendous push of his thick, thewed legs, Batman launches across. And we had a scene in Batman Family Number One where Robin had some thick thighs as well. So I don't know if that was a thing, but I did think of you, Sean, on that one. I thought you might like that. So.
Well, I thought I overdid it on the thong comment, so I didn't want to push it.
That might be something you guys need to keep track of in Batman Family. Is any thick thigh related stuff?
Thick-thewed legs. So, I love the guy. The death trap, however, if it wasn't in the middle of his art room, it's a pretty cool trap, right? You fall into it, and then a giant granite stone comes down to smush you. So that's a pretty cool trap. It's just, you think, oh, if it gets off by a degree, you're going to smash into some pieces of art.
What did you guys think of the word ladder at the end of the story featuring the little boy and the statted head of Batman stuck in there to make it look like it was Batman related?
I was like, huh? What does this have to do? I was too distracted by Bruce's outfit with his ascot and his smoking jacket.
I love Batman's rich guy attire that they had, which they kept going all the way into the 80s. It's fantastic. Yeah. So it's a fun story. But again, Neil Adams is the sort of thing that's selling it.
Yep. Yeah.
So then after that is one last bonus feature, which is a pinup by Carmen Infantino and Murphy Anderson. We've all seen this image a million times. Yeah. Oddly enough, it was never a comic book cover. It was the cover to the Batman 30s to the 70s book, I believe. Mm-hmm. But it was never actually a comic book cover. And it's got that same weird doily design around it, but I mean it's a classic image that we've seen in a million pieces of merchandising, and so you got a page to fill, why not?
That's that one we know is Infantino and Murphy Anderson, because that's a famous one.
That picture.
And then on the inside cover we've got the key to the Wayne Foundation, which of course is Paul we know referenced many times as a child going back and forth and looking at these things. And then the back cover is a Batman drawing that looks like it probably came off a coloring book. I don't know who did this. It doesn't seem to kind of fit the style of anything else in this book. It's not bad per se, but it is very simplistic. And I'm sort of at a loss to figure out who the hell drew that.
Well, I can't keep referencing the old Grand Comics database. They guessed and put a question mark. They guessed that Vince Coletta did the inks for it, but they have a question mark in the pencils. I mean, his face and sort of barrel chest looks like Kurt Swan to me, so Kurt Swan with Vince Coletta, I could see, cause there's like no background in the
buildings.
The buildings are like, stick buildings. So I could see this being a, hey Vinny, we need this done this afternoon. Okay. I'll take care of it for you. And then they took.
I love your attempt at an Italian accent there, Paul.
The buildings remind me of like a fifth grade production where like the background would be cardboard.
Yeah, I think I saw that. They did On the Town, I believe, when I was in fifth grade. I think that's what that is. So that's the end of the Treasury. Overall, a very fun book. It features a side of the Neil Adams story, Danny O'Neill Neil Adams story, I should say. It features a much lighter Batman than what DC was trying to sell. as Batman at the time. They were really kind of getting him back to the Dark Knight gritty thing. And yet three of these stories are kind of more lighthearted, a little more TV showish Batman. But again, you know, DC loved pulling stories from their vast history. So it's kind of a nice balance that you've got some 40s Batman and probably some 50s Batman. I think Batman 87 is 50s. And then you've got 60s Batman and 70s Batman. So it's, you know, it is literally Batman 30s to the 40s to the 70s, basically.
Yeah, that I was scratching my head on the theme. I mean, on the cover it says a baffling mystery stories. You know, that's kind of overselling it a little bit in terms of the baffling mystery stories. But other than that, I didn't see as much tying it together as some of the other treasuries. But boy, you know, it's a lot of fun. So it's worth it.
Yeah, and Batman would go on to star in about a dozen other DC treasuries, but they would be kind of like they would become their own sort of like a trade paperback. So they were collecting the Ra's al Ghul story and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and they realized that you know they kind of got out of this a little. These sort of like career retrospectives sort of thing. Cause they had just earlier done the villain centric one that we covered on the very first episode of the show, which is like one of my favorite treasures of all time, but otherwise it's a really solid collection. And you know, there was a lot of Batman out there. And by the way, this drawing of Batman, the Carmine Infantino was used for the house ad talking about Batman and all the titles you can get Batman in, which of course included Batman Family.
Yep. And in fact, in that ad runs in Batman Family number 2, and you can hear us talk about that the first week of February.
Plug, plug, plug.
Now I think we might be related.
There we go. So, boys, thank you so much for coming back onto the show collectively to talk about some more Batman with me. We've all been really enjoying Batman Family Reunion, and I'm really proud to have it as part of the network. So, I wish you all the luck in the world with the show going forward. So thanks for coming by again.
Well, thanks for having us, Rob. We appreciate it. And it was just a lot of fun to be back on Treasury Cast.
Thanks, Rob. We have a big slab of angel food cake waiting for you at Wayne Gardens anytime you want to come to the reunion.
Sounds good. So, all right, everybody, stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Ryan, I know we're taking a break from Batman Nightcast, but I've been thinking about the Nightfall storyline where Jean-Paul Vallée temporarily took over the role of Batman.
I see where you're going with this. If you were ever paralyzed, I would be honored to take care of Cindy and your kids.
No, that's not where I was going. I was thinking about all the many characters who have filled in for Bruce Wayne as Batman over the years. Dick Grayson, Tim Drake.
Commissioner Gordon, for some reason.
Yeah, that did happen. Anyway, on the subject of temporary replacements.
Your son Andrew is going to take over Supermates?
No, focus on Batman. Why is this so hard? While we're away from Nightcast for a while longer, someone could come in and do a Batman-related show for the Fire and Water Network.
Well, I know Paul Keen loves the Batman Family comic book.
I've seen Sean M. Myers post a few things about Batman Family, too.
Do you think they'd...
We'll do it! For those of you who aren't familiar with the series, Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978. And then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980.
The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Ragman and the Demon.
So you're all invited to the Batman Family Reunion podcast, taking over the Batman Nightcast feed.
Coming in January to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
This could be the sensational podcast find of 2022.
The Long Halloween. Hush. Dark Knight Returns. The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad... overlooked.
and that's where we come in. Hi, everybody. My name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index index show.
Our goal is to talk about the previously mentioned overlooked stories and tell you why they're worth your time.
The show comes out twice a month, with the first episode focusing on the Bat books from the late 70s and early 80s. We're starting with the Len Wein run and working our way forward through the books written by Jerry Conway and eventually Doug Mensch.
On the second episode of the month, we'll dig into the various adventure comics that were based on the Fox Kids / Kids WB Batman animated shows, because they're really good and hardly anyone seems to remember that they exist.
The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
And we're back with listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the website, findwaterpodcast.com, for episode 64, which is the giant superhero grab bag with my pal Chris Franklin. First up is Matt Sorois, who says, great episode, but then every time Mr. Kelly and Mr. Franklin coax an episode, it's great. I think I can listen to the two of you talk about what you do with holiday leftovers. It's a lot of vegetarian stuff for me, man. Nick Fury is holding an official Commando Cordy carbine action disrupted ray gun with a compass in the stock. Okay, I have no idea what he's holding, but I'm betting his headgear was used to cover up his great temples to make it easier to meet women at the singles bar. I absolutely adore the Hulk dressed up as Santa holding the kid on his lap. Hulk may hate puny humans, but he was always good with kids. It's obvious that Marvel wanted their two biggest superstars, Hulk and Spider-Man, to be in the treasury. Those two are undoubtedly what sold the majority of the books. Parents and grandparents would recognize them and make the purchase for the young superhero fan on their Christmas list. I also get that Marvel didn't have holiday-specific tales to reprint in them. I just don't get why they decided Spidey, he's a psychiatrist, as the tale they did pick. Really? Of all the Spidey stories published up to that point, that's the one they chose? Anyway, thanks for another great listen. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and a very happy 2022. And then Matt follows up with, P.S., the back cover is great. I love how Santa is seemingly sending the heroes off to do his bidding. On Fury, on Cage, on Spidey and Strange. Big joy to the world. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. Very nice, Matt. Yeah, I believe that officially makes Santa a member of the Defenders at this point, non-team. Again, thank you for the comments. Ado Boznar says, all right, I have to admit that back when I was in third grade, so 1977, I had a Red Skull Halloween costume. Basically, I wanted something that had crossover appeal. Comic readers would get the reference, while normies, or muggles, I guess, would just think it's some kind of ghoul with a bright red skull face. The implications suggesting it's a Nazi were kind of lost on me at the time. Otherwise, I have to push back a bit on Mr. Franklin's assertion that even Ditko's women looked kind of off. Not true. He tended to draw very attractive women. They were distinctly done in his style, but they were usually quite fetching as depicted. This is particularly true of Peter's potential love interests, Betty Brant, Liz Allen, and Gwen Stacy. In fact, I'll add that personally, I was never a fan of the way Jack Kirby drew women then or afterwards. Finally, on the topic of having cliffhanger stories in reprint books like this one, I'm reminded of one that confounded and frustrated me for years. In Son of Origins, the Iron Man story from Tales of Suspense number 197 97, was reprinted after the I Am Origin story. It's just one installment in a longer story arc that ends on a complete cliffhanger. I finally read the rest of the story only a few years later, which I wrote about at some length at another site, the Atomic Junk Shop. Anyway, great story as usual, gentlemen. It's a bit sad to know you're running out of holiday grab bags to discuss. Yes, I have Son of Origins. That's a fun book. God, I gotta have to cover those Fireside books. We did one episode on them, but there's more to do. But yeah, there were some weird choices in there. You know, there were some like kind of middle chapter stories. I don't know why they decided to do some of that. Brett Young says, happy belated holidays, everyone. I finally had time enough to myself to enjoy the holiday grab bag episode. Nothing says Christmas like domestic terrorism and mental health issues. I view that as more of a January thing, but maybe that's just me. Man, I know it's a grab bag, but maybe Marvel should have grabbed some more Christmassy stories. But it's the thought that counts, so I will say I enjoy the cover. Nice to see Cage decorate the tree with a chain, and Nick Fury get a new Kirby-themed hookah pipe. Then the heroes all gather on the back cover to beat up some baddies at Santa's behest. A true classic. Thank you, Brett. Wordle Terry says, what a delightful pair of podcasters. What a decidedly odd pack of stories. Next year, I hope Rudolph. You know, Ward Hill, I do want to get to those at some point, and I had some plans, and they sort of fell through, but hopefully at some point we will get to the Christmas Eve Rudolph treasures. That is in on my clipboard of a mental clipboard of things to do. And then finally, Martin Gray says, this sounds like a poor effort in terms of content. If Marvel had no suitable Christmas stories starring their marquee characters, they might have used good one and done starring anybody and had Spidey and Hulk present them either via the contents page or little strips pasted onto page one. That has to be better for the little kid than stories with not a sniff of snow. Looking at the gallery, Hate-Monger's power looks to inspire laughter. That's not the most forbidding of poses. And that outfit. Go on, I admit it. It's really Aunt May, Doctor Strange, in the final pasted up panel. Also looks like a right old mincer. Mind, I did love that new look. I'm with Ado. Ditko's ladies has a certain allure, especially Clea. Right? Well, that's two votes for Ditko women. So thanks, everybody, for the comments. Very much appreciate it. And that's going to wrap up this episode of Treasure Cast. Big thanks to Paul Kien and Sean Myers for coming back to the show. We're very happy to have them as part of the network, and we're all enjoying Batman Family Reunion. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Treasure Cast over on our website, FrineWaterPodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
You're one of those who just can't get enough of Batman. Help is here.
Hey, Jefferson and 12.
Hold tight, bat turn.
Sometimes I think people expect too much of us, Batman.
They have a right to expect it.
But we're only human.
There. Feel better? It's only temporary relief, we know. But the next episode is just a few bat hours away.